Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Energy Series. Pierre Desrochers is an associate professor of geography at the University of Toronto, Mississauga campus. He's a man who's quite convincing, and he has some interesting ideas to present. Here's a taste and a test. What in the 19th century simultaneously saved the sperm whale from extinction, allowed America's forests to grow back, and cleaned up America's cities? Why, oil, of course. Here's Professor Desrochers. Pierre Desrochers, the Save the Whales is a great slogan. And actually, you're going to help us understand how they were once saved from certain extinction in the 19th century, not the 20th century or the 21st century. Interesting fact.
Yeah, it's an irony that is lost on many people. I mean, Greenpeace would have had no whales left to save in the 1970s if it hadn't been for the oil industry in the second half of the 19th century. People tend to forget that the first major commodity that came out of petroleum was actually kerosene, which was used as a substitute for whale oil. Up until the middle of the 19th century, whale oil was the prime fueled used in the countrysides and people who were outside of cities. There was an alternative in the city called coal gas. I mean, people would eat coal with steam, and so urban markets were well served. But if you lived in the countryside, you wouldn't want to buy whale oil, and especially oil from sperm whales. Think of Moby Dick, but you know, the
real color of black ones. Yeah, of course, and Nantucket was the whaling
capital.
Yeah.
And that's because they had an organ in their nose, spermaceti, which provided by far the best oil for lighting.
Because the melon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the whole head, and that's because the oil that came from the sperm whales did not emit any smoke. It provided better light. And so, yeah, so they were almost hunted to extinction in the 19th century, but fortunately, John D. Rockefeller and a few other people came along and actually saved the whales then.
And I'm teasing, tweaking some of the viewers watching with that factoid, but I read a fascinating piece by you where you enumerate all the various indirect and forgotten forms of progress that derive from the exploitation of oil. And it's counterintuitive. We think of oil as dirty and smelly and polluting, but other things were more so.
Yeah, and you have to understand that the real feature of technological progress is creating lesser problems than those that existed before. And so, of course, petroleum products were never perfect. But compare, let's say, when tractors came along, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century, roughly 20% of the food produced on American farms was used to feed horses and mules, which were used to produce the food. And so the tractor comes along, and suddenly you don't need those animals anymore. So food become a lot more abundant, and paradoxically, you need a lot less land over time to produce food than was the case a century ago. So because of petroleum-derived products, let's say fertilizers, pesticides, again, tractors, diesel, all these things, we produce something like 8 times more corn on the same piece of land in the United States today than we did a century ago. And what has happened over the last century is that because we've become so good at growing so much more food on less land than in the past, forests have made a tremendous comeback in all advanced economies. I mean, every country that is at the level of development of Chile, let's say about $5,000 per year in terms of GDP, is seeing its forest cover either make a comeback, or in places like Japan where it has no room to grow, its quality has improved significantly over time. So paradoxically, tapping into fossil fuels and petroleum in particular has given us the opportunity to spare a lot of land that was used very inefficiently in the past. And nature has benefited tremendously from fossil fuels.
There's one statistic in your article that struck me. There are more trees in America and in the United States standing today than there was
in 1920. And significantly, I mean, even countries like France, again, you have to understand, if you go back in time a century and a half ago, because producing food was so arduous, because the yields were so low, people were producing food in the Appalachians, you know, on hilly slopes, rocky terrains, and that's because moving the stuff around was difficult, and at the same time, you could only produce so much food. So paradoxically, all these lands have been abandoned, and you travel across the Americas, across the United States today, and you see forests that have grown back. I mean, I'm from Quebec, which is just across the border from Vermont and New Hampshire. Most people today don't realize that a century ago, a century and a half ago, there were very few trees left along border states because a lot of this land was used either to graze sheep or to produce hay for horses in cities like Boston and New York, or to produce oats and various types of horse feed. But again, with...
Vermont was not... Now it's one big park.
Exactly. It's over 90% forested.
And that was not the case.
That was not the case a century and a century and a half ago. And it is petroleum, in a way, that has reforested Vermont and made it the ecotourist mecca that it has become. But the truth about Vermont is that it was the first state to really deindustrialize and to lose its farming sector, essentially, to petroleum products.
And getting back to horses. Horses, you described how they took up a lot of the food that they themselves produced. But in cities, they were a problem
terrible.
Too. Even though we like to see the old movies and the stagecoach pulls up and they tie the thing around the post and they go to the saloon and it sounds like a lot of fun. But anyway, I'll let you.
Well, in small towns, it was fun, but you can find old pictures in places like Boston and New York City, for example. You would literally have horse hotels in the middle of those cities. And what I mean by that, buildings in which you would have, four or five, six stories buildings, which would be full of horses. So think of all the manure, the horse urine, and so horses were actually a great source of typhoid fever a century ago because, of course, cities were full of horse manure or horse
20 pounds per horse per day.
Yes, per day.
I couldn't believe it.
And you would have a lot of flies, too. And, people did not have good pesticides to control flies in those days. So many thousands of people died of things like typhoid fever in the large American cities until the car came along. And one anecdote that I do not describe in this paper is that the first urban planning meeting that was conveyed, the first big one in the 1880s in New York City, was canceled after 2 days because all the urban planners were like, well, we'll never solve the problem of horses in cities, so urban life is impossible. We need to get out of cities and spread, if you will, human presence across the continent. But yeah, the first cars were, of course, very polluting by today's standards, mm-hmm. but they were a tremendous progress compared to horses.
And even dead carcasses, horses were left to rot. The manure. There was like 2 gallons of urine a day per horse.
Yes.
And there were tens of thousands of horses, almost as many as people.
Yes. But
also people would abandon them.
People would abandon them. I mean, the best dead horses were maybe collected by, glue manufacturers. But the old horses that were left to rot on the streets were fairly common. And again, you go back to, you see old pictures of horses abandoned in places like Brooklyn, for example, mm-hmm. and little kids playing around them. And we tend to forget today that, we all have this obsession about the modern synthetic pesticides, but germs and diseases from dead horses were much more significant at one point in time.
And another thing that fascinated me is you went back to books written in 1908, 1920, that indicate that in an odd way, and you say Karl Marx had predicted this, incredible, waste byproducts of oil ended up being useful and economical in ways that even the guys looking for oil hadn't guessed.
And not guessed, yeah. Well, the first big problem that the first oil drillers had was natural gas. I mean, you cannot find petroleum without finding natural gas. And at first, people did not know what to do with it because, they were still using very primitive equipment. So on the one end, people were always happy to find petroleum, but they were risking their lives every time because, of course, the natural gas would come out.
Would
blow back. And people would not know what to do with it. So they were happy to find petroleum, but then they would basically flare or burn the natural gas for several days before they dare going back to their derrick. But of course, over time, people realize, well, we can actually do something with that stuff. And very early on, natural gas was trapped and sent to steel factories, among other things. But petroleum is even more interesting. I mean, people tend today to forget. I mean, petroleum is an oil like any other. You let it rest and various fractions mm-hmm. will emerge in it. And at first, what people were interested in is what was called the middle fraction of the barrel. So things like kerosenes or other products.
Gasoline
was on the top, and it was
too
volatile.
Nobody knew what to do with it.
What to do with it, because if you tried to burn it in an oil lamp, it would blow up in your face. And so there was this big waste for a few years. Gasoline, people didn't know what to do with. But then people began thinking, okay, what could we do with it? And eventually, some clever minds came up with the internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, gasoline caffeine was the most significant. It became at one point the main product, even though at first it was a waste and then a byproduct. But then every other things that we take for granted today, you know, everything from paraffin in the early days to all sorts of
feedstock.
Well, asphalt is actually the second largest.
That's from the bottom of the
barrel. From the bottom. Yeah, that's the heaviest fraction. At first, you know, people might use some of it for roofing, but that was it. Paved roads only actually came with the automobiles. There was not enough of an incentive before. And paving roads in city was actually, again, another tremendous public health advance. Because before that, of course, when roads were not paved, I mean, you might have cobblestone roads and things like that in cities, but you had a tremendous amount of dust and particulate emissions in cities because of that. So paving the roads actually made city a lot cleaner and also paradoxically a lot quieter because, again, horses on cobblestones were making a lot of noise. Cities, you know, people think that cities are noisy today, but they were probably even noisier before the car and asphalt came
along. With the horses and the horseshoes and smellier.
Yes, of course.
With the manure and so on. But I can, some of the people who have not yet left the living room and the TV set and we're still watching, some of them will be blowing steam, not gasoline, saying, listen, it may be Vermont owes its forests today to the fact that oil is used, but what do you say about fracking and small donkey arrangements all over North Dakota? Is that not ruining the landscape and ruining nature?
Well, you know, there are 7 billion of us right now, human beings. We'll be 9 billion soon. So obviously human beings will always have an impact on nature. So the issue is not having an impact or not having an impact, but minimizing our impact while improving standards of living. And so if you take a look at, let's say, fracking, okay, of course, no technology is perfect. But paradoxically, the performance of the United States as an economy in terms of greenhouse gas emission has actually improved and much faster than Europe over the last few years because coal has increasingly been substituted by natural gas, which emits less greenhouse gas emissions per unit of energy. So instead of going the European way with, you know, the cap and trade system and trying to come up with bureaucratic solutions to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, in the United States, people have been substituting coal, which was already cheap, by natural gas obtained through fracking, which is even cheaper for purely economic reason. But as a result, greenhouse gas emissions in the United States have been going down dramatically in the last few years. So if you believe that greenhouse gas emissions are a problem, yes, fracking is not perfect, but it is still better than the alternatives that we had before. So again, keep in mind that progress is defined by creating lesser problems than those we solve. And I would submit that overall, the beauty of fossil fuels in general is that, you know, they come from underground. They give us the opportunity to actually spare the surface, which is what we really care about. So as long as things are done properly, I guess if you take a look at the global picture regarding fossil fuels, it is much more positive than most people are willing to entertain.
Now, underground is reassuring in one sense, but then it calls into question aquifers and drinking water. That's scary with fracking. Some people are worried that one will touch the other, migrate to the other.
Yes, but okay, two things here. Keep in mind that the water today is much safer than it was two centuries ago. If you go back to, let's say, the days of George Washington or John Adams, I'm saying that because the TV series John Adams was on TV not too long ago. John Adams was famous for drinking only apple cider because water quality was so bad in those days. You know, animals would defecate in water. It would come into contact with all sorts of contaminants. So paradoxically, fossil fuels have made our supply water cleaner because by getting people off the farm, by making us more productive, we found ways to purify water, which was a big issue historically. And with fracking, typically, the gas is found way below, you know, a mile or two below the type of aquifer that we get our water from. So there have been lawsuits in the United States, which have been debunked by, among other things, you know, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Environmental Division of the State of Pennsylvania. So, you know, there was bad quality water before fracking came along because natural gas could be found close to the surface. This is not a new problem. But you look at the quality of our water supply today, compared to what it was, again, before fossil fuels came along. And it is incomparably better. I mean, I don't know anybody in George Washington days that would want to drink water from their days as opposed to our days if they were somehow to appear in the room today.
And there's one topic you deal with, which is the, you don't use that word, but I mean, it comes off like that, the illusion of cleanliness that surrounds certain new technologies, but they're so inefficient. And here I'm thinking of wind and solar. Yes. It is clean, isn't it? Wind and sun.
Yes, but it doesn't deliver power, and that's the problem.
Yeah, well, I'll let you pose your objection. That's it. They just can't do the job.
Well, think of it this way. You know, Europe was covered with windmills when the steam engine came along. And every little brook in France, every little stream, actually had the mini, it was not obviously hydroelectric, but, you know, a mill on it. 2 centuries ago, the problem was that, of course, you know, windmills don't give you anything when the wind doesn't blow, and especially in Mediterranean climates, you often lack water in the summer to power your mill. So what people were pointing out in the middle of the 19th century, it was, aren't steam engines wonderful? They work all the time. They give us so much more power than windmills and water mills. So no wonder that people were so keen. You know, again, steam engines were kind of dirty by today's standards, obviously. But they were working all the time, and they could do a tremendous amount of work, and people could see the trade-offs back in those days. Now, today, the problem with wind turbines is that, well, we haven't solved the problem. We call it intermittency in the jargon, but let's just say they only work when the wind blows. And again, when the wind doesn't blow too hard either, because then you've got to shut them down. Mm-hmm. And you need to mine rare earths to put into them, which is very polluting. And you always need backup. Because, you know, there's no giant battery to power our grid system. You need to produce electricity continuously. So when the wind doesn't blow, what do you do? Well, typically you bring on a gas turbine, or perhaps if you can manage that coal-fired power station, or if you have them, even better, an hydroelectric dam. But the point is that solar and wind only produce small amounts of intermittent energy, and we cannot power our modern societies with that. And the real issue is, you know, do you want to be operated upon by a surgeon when the electricity only comes from a wind turbine? I don't think so. You know, again, there's a reason why we've developed the imperfect but obviously superior technologies that we use today.
And in the case of wind, I think there's other noise, aesthetics, there's all kinds of
raptors.
But in the case of solar, to be fair, if there were a better technology, cheaper, less expensive, more efficient technology, the sun is free. And it is up there for good.
Yes.
And solar might one day be the oil of tomorrow in the sense that...
And then it will win market shares without subsidies. Mm-hmm. But, what if you live in Stockholm or Alaska where, you know, you've got 4 hours of sunlight in the middle
of
winter?
Of course, even in the best scenario.
Exactly.
But all I'm saying is I'd rather bet money on solar in 50 years than wind.
Oh.
Because wind will always remain very...
Or perhaps something else will come along that we cannot
that we
imagine today. Because that's another thing I point out in the book. You know, when petroleum first came along in the 19th century, a lot of very smart people were very skeptical. They say, well, coal works so well. Why would you waste energy trying to develop petroleum? There's only so little of it. People had no idea how abundant mm-hmm. petroleum was at the time. But I think if the history of technology policy and energy development teaches us something is that nobody knows anything about the future.
No, quite true. Well, 5 years ago, we were talking about peak oil.
Yes.
And that oil was going to end soon.
Yes.
$200 a barrel.
And that's always the paradox. You know, we live on a finite planet, obviously, but people always talk about, well, easily accessible deposits. Well, drilling 60 feet underground a century and a half ago was about as expensive as, you know, if you go on the ocean today, you drive, you first go 2 miles below ocean levels, then you go another 4 miles underground, then perhaps 6 miles in one direction. It's about the same price in terms of oil extraction as it was drilling in the best deposits 150 years ago. People tend to forget that geology is one thing, but all the technologies and know-how that we've developed over time actually expand the pool of oil that we can tap into, mm-hmm. if you will. So, yes, our planet is finite, but paradoxically, there are more oil reserves today than there were 10 years ago, than there were 30 years ago, than there were 150 years ago. So because because our evolutionary advantage is really our brain, we found better ways to tap into increasingly remote deposits. And paradoxically, there are more resources on Earth now than 10 years ago because we keep creating them.
And would you blame Is it inherently, I'm thinking now of one of the dangers of oil, which is when it's accumulated in on a boat like the Exxon Valdez, sure. or when it's being drilled for in the Gulf, is the accidents, the spills. Is that due to our negligence? And if we had better security and put more money into better boats and better drilling, it wouldn't happen? Or is it a risk that we've decided to take and we take it?
No system is perfect. But again, you've got to keep... Well, I would argue that in most cases, these malfunctions were due mostly to human error. I mean, certainly the Exxon Valdez thing. But again, why do we keep talking about the Exxon Valdez almost 2 decades after the accident happened? Because there are relatively few accidents. I would submit. So, of course, if you go to a country
it's
like
that... It's because the boat was so big.
Yeah, no, yes, the boat was big.
And it stained the coast.
Yes.
And that lasted a long time.
But can
and
you
nobody wants to walk around in the muck.
No, I agree with you, of course. But the point I'm trying to make here is that these things don't happen every year. So, yes, I mean, this was a tragedy, and I'm really sad that it happened. But at the same time, we do still talk about the Exxon Valdez today because these accidents are kind of rare, at least in the context of advanced economies. Of course, you go to a country like, let's say, Nigeria, that might have lower environmental standards, and there are serious issues there. But I would argue that if you look at the safety record of the industry over time, it has become better. And, you know, there are different ways to move oil. For example, you can use boats, you can use trucks, but by far the safest and cheapest is pipelines, mm-hmm. which unfortunately have a bad press today. But I would submit that if you look at all the benefits that we get from oil compared to the few accidents that might happen here and there, which again, if you think of the amount of product that we moved around, I would argue that, you know, this is a trade-off that as a society we've decided to make, and I would argue that we're the better off for it. But this is not to say, of course, that we should not try to do better.
And in the same text, I was struck. You want environmentalism to progress using free market solutions.
Yes.
And you believe that then those solutions would be much more stable. For instance, in Africa, owning the wildlife and the wild spaces,
yes.
letting the citizens own that would protect them better.
It's just a matter of giving incentive to people. You know, when you own a house, you take much better care of it than when you rent it from someone else. I work on a university campus with some fraternity houses not too far. So, you know, I will let you guess, which houses are better maintained. So when people own resources, they tend to think about the long term, if for no other reason, that they might sell them to someone else one day. Mm-hmm. So they have every incentive to maintain the value of the resource. By contrast, when a resource belongs to no one, no one takes care of it.
Or when it belongs to everyone, it belongs to no one.
It belongs to no one, yes.
But is there any hope for that? The collective property of certain things, well,
yes.
National parks, that's seen as a good thing.
Yes.
Is it or isn't it?
No. What's interesting, if you look at the history of, let's say, Yellowstone National Park, which was the first national park in the United States, the person who actually promoted that was born in Canada, by the way, which is not something that many people realize.
Wasn't Teddy Roosevelt?
No, it was not. No. Teddy Roosevelt visited Yellowstone. The park existed long before him. It was created in the 1870s. But it's because the owner of the main railroad between Minneapolis and Seattle was looking for a reason to, you know, generate business along the way. And it so happened that the train came close to this area, which was called Yellowstone, which was not suitable for other types of development because it was at too high an altitude. But it was really beautiful, and it had all these geysers and other things. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of lobbying, actually, by a private railroad owner, to create the first U.S. national park because he wanted to draw tourists and he wanted people to use his railroad. Mm. So this is an aspect
incredible,
of Yellowstone history that people are often not aware of.
But we can agree that in developed countries...
But then again, you see, we can only spare so much land because, again, of petroleum products or fossil fuels in general. If we were to revert back to old-fashioned ways of producing food, we would need about at least 150% more agricultural land than we use at the moment. And all of the world forests would be plowed under. I mean, there might be pressure by a few wealthy people to save land for other uses, but people will always want to eat first. And again, because we produce so much food on a lot less land than in the past, we've been able to set aside the most beautiful part of nature, or at least the one that human beings enjoy the most, into things like national parks. But think of it this way. People would not have visited national parks before fossil fuel. I mean, most people only moved a few miles beyond their homes.
Yeah.
Because before the railroad came along, moving on stagecoach was not very efficient. You know, traveling from Montreal to Boston took you several days. Then the railroad came and people were able to travel a little bit more. And then the car came and people began traveling a little bit more. So here again is another incentive to protect nature, which would not have existed before fossil fuels came along.
Well, believe me, the people who have listened to us today, the next time they drive through Vermont and look at those great forests or they see a documentary on whales, will be forced to think about some of these things. So thank you for helping us with that.
Thank you.
Pierre Desrochers was our guest this week on the Energy Series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.